child in his own mind cannot view himself as being evil. So, but the Jew is evil. In order for him to have the psychological capacity to express his hatred, he's got to be able to justify it. That's why Hitler was so dangerous. That's what made Hitler so dangerous, because he was able to take the basest emotions and put it into the framework of a noble ideal. Then when the people reach that level, then they're totally destroyed. That's enough. Because now there's only one thing to restrain him. There's only one faculty that restrains the aggressiveness, and that is the conscience. That's the superego, which is contrary to the desires of the instincts. But when you've been able to pervert the conscience, and the conscience itself is telling you that it's a mitzvah, so now all the aggression is now going to be given the opportunity to express itself. There's nothing to hold it back, and that's when you have an individual. That's what Farrakhan is basically trying to do. He's trying to end it. So that's precisely the purpose of the anti-Semitism, to show that it's to appeal to the aggressiveness. People are attracted to a movement which gives them an opportunity to vent their aggressiveness. And you have, in order to do so, you have to show that this is really the ideal thing to do. So the fact that the Jew is associated with the mitzvot is the cause, but the fact which enables the Gentile to vent his anti-Semitism is when the Jew deviates from himself. Then he's more vulnerable. He's more vulnerable. It would say, the question is, in other words, in which situation is the Jew more subject to the persecution? When he's keeping the Torah, and when he's abandoning the Torah. According to this, it's when he's abandoning the Torah. Because when he abandons the Torah, then the Gentile loses his fear. He's not even keeping, he has the justification. And not only that, but then I'll tell you something else. He mentioned the two things over here. He kept the mitzvot, and he didn't learn from his evil ways. Two important ideas. It's a very important lesson for us to learn in a society. There's a certain built-in envy of the Jew, and that is because the Jews have the Torah. Okay, so that can't be changed. But the Gentile does take a certain comfort, but we have the material world, we have the physical. Let's say Rambi is a person who is wealthy. Most people are the opposite. Most people are Rambi is the wealthy person. Yeah, but you have, he has four houses, mansions, and so on, and cars. But let's say you feel pride, but you've made a discovery. You have knowledge. That's your job. So you can tolerate that. You can tolerate this. Even if you're on the level of envy. In truth, the type of person would be envious, because he realizes there's no benefit in life. But then let's say you're not on that level. When a person's on the level of envy, so he has this, but then your own mind goes back to what you have. But I have that. Yeah. So that compensates. But if that person who you've envied wealthy should suddenly now also spend a few years and become a scholar, and he has more knowledge than you, then you're going to be totally devastated. Because that's your thing. That's my thing. Now, in a similar way, so the Gentile can tolerate, so you have your Torah, and you have your mitzvahs, as long as you keep your area, and I have the world of the physical. But when the Jew breaks out of that, and he goes off into, and he competes with the Gentile, and he's economically, he's making more money than he is, and he has more of the material. So now he has both, then the Gentile can't take it. Then the hatred becomes, then he has nothing to withdraw into. Now he's totally devastated. He's totally devastated, and he has no, and there's no barrier holding him back from protecting the Jew, because you're not a good person. You're not a, as long as I feel that the other person is a righteous individual, it's very difficult. In other words, if a Gentile, even an anti-Semite, he takes a look at the Jews, and he sees that they work hard, and they're very scrupulous, they're very honest in their business dealings, and they help other people, and they contribute, and even when they have money, they don't flaunt it. So it's very hard. He's not going to go around killing it. It's very, even though he hates him, even though there's the hatred because of the envy, but there's just a grudging respect. And what can he say? Look at these people. They contribute to the society. There was a drive for funds, you know, because of victims of a flood, which wasn't even Jews, and Jews came and they helped and this and that. You can't. Insofar as they are human and they have a conscience, they can't vent their hatred. It's just going to be held back. But when the Jews, when they have an opportunity to say, ah, these Jews, they cheat in business, they cheat you, they try to take advantage of you, and then, and they only care about their own, and they pose as being a righteous people, but you see they're just as materialistic as anybody else. And when that happens, so then it makes it easier for them to express. In other words, the underlying cause is not the behavior. That's the only people that study anti-Semitism that had this problem. Because whatever cause you're going to say, the Jews do this, the Jews do that, they'll say, well, other people do the same thing, and it doesn't lead to the same result. So the underlying cause is the fact, it's an unconscious phenomenon. That's what Yaakov realized. But he realized that it would be important for, not in an overt way, that's why it was a subtle way, to communicate to Laban the picture of what Yaakov was like at this time, that he hasn't changed. He has not embraced materialistic values, and he hasn't learned from the evil ways of Laban. Because then he realized if he looked at him that way, then he'd be in much greater danger. But if he regarded him as someone who all he cared about was the tent, he just wanted to be in the tent of Torah, and he just wanted to do mitzvahs, so then he wasn't a threat to Esav. On the level where he had the materialistic as well as the spiritual, and that's the explanation of that chazal. In love on garti, I think it's the way it fits into the word is in love on garti. Garti implies that I didn't really. It means just a temporary phenomenon. I just happened to be there with him, sojourn. It was a sojourn, but it was nothing. I didn't identify. You see the. The term is designed in such a way that it communicates the idea that there was no real relationship between us. I didn't form a relationship. I didn't identify with him. Yeah. According to the explanation, we're not saying the hatred, believe me, the hatred that 20 years later the desire to kill was not because he had lied to me at one point in time. That wasn't. The underlying hatred of Esau for Yaakov realized very well, was not because of an incident. An incident can be straightened out. Right? It was rather because he had made a choice in life. At the age of 15, he had chosen the materialistic. And Yaakov had opted for the Torah. And they were both raised in the house of Torah. Both of them were raised where they both knew that the ultimate good is Torah. And Yaakov was able to act on that and live his life in accordance with that. And then Esau renounced it. He couldn't live his life in accordance with the Torah. But underneath it all, he recognized that Torah was the real good. And that was the real cause of the hatred. It wasn't because of the law. I forgot to mention, the proof, the historical proof that this is the case, the greatest part is Germany itself, where the Jews achieved the highest degree of assimilation. And the worst tragedy occurred in Germany. So you see that the Jews themselves thought that the problem is because if we're Jewish and if we will be just like our neighbors, so then they'll accept us. And the German Jews were the most assimilated Jews of any people in Europe. And they suffered the worst fate. So you see, there's a connection over there. Well, the more the Jew assimilates into and seeks to emulate the Gentile, the part of the Gentile, the greater. It doesn't reduce the anti-Semitism, but according to this interpretation, we see it historically, and according to the interpretation, it may not increase it. It may increase it, but what it does is it removes the dam which is blocking it from being expressed. So just to summarize, we're saying that the strategy of Yaakov was based upon the fact that he recognized that there were two forces in Israel. There was the force of hatred, which was based upon a certain envy of Yaakov. That Yaakov had the thing which was truly worthwhile, the knowledge, the learning. But then there was another factor, a barrier. Something which prevented him from expressing the hatred. And he realized that barrier was based upon how he would perceive him. And if he would perceive him as being a righteous person, now righteous meant that he would keep the mitzvahs, but more important than that was that he was righteous in the ethical sense. He did not learn from the ways of loving. He didn't cheat, he didn't care. He was totally honest and ethical and goodly in all of his dealings. then it would be impossible for Esav to express his hatred because the barrier would be in effect. That was the strategy of Yaakov. Just asking a question here in Vayishlach. The Ramban says that the purpose of this parasha is to teach us that God saves his servant. Well, that itself contains two ideas. One is that there's such a thing as providence in terms of the personal life, contrary to the natural order, that God intervenes to save. But that's not for everybody, because he says as Abdo, as someone who is the Eved Hashem, who's deserving. He has to be on a certain level where he warrants it. And he redeemed him from one who was stronger than him. Vayishlach Malach, and he sent an angel, Vayatileir, and he saved him. Alright, we'll just pause there because he goes on and tells us that he teaches us other things. But if that is the case, if this is a true idea of Torah, that God does send an angel, so to speak, which means a force, it's a force of God, to redeem the tzaddik, the Eved, from someone who's stronger, so did Yaakov know this idea, or didn't he know this idea? So we should assume that he knew the idea. If that's the case, so then a lot of the things become questionable. Why did he have to make all of these preparations when these preparations were insufficient? These preparations were really pointless, because we're talking about someone who was stronger than him. Meaning to say, in the framework of the natural arena, he would not have been able to win. He would not have been able to win because Esav was stronger. And he only won because of God. So, first of all, I guess there are two questions then. Why did Yaakov even bother doing anything at all? That's the first question. The second question is, the things that he did, what was the point in doing those things if they're futile? If there's nothing that you can do? Do you understand why they're two separate questions? They're two separate questions. One question is, if God saved the one who is Eved, so then there's no need to do anything, even if there's something that I can do. Why do it? I can just sit back and learn. But there's another question. What's the point? Even if you're going to explain to me that no, he has to do. But that presupposes that there's something that you can do. If I am, if I'm being confronted by a force of 10,000 people, armed with every kind of weapon, and I have five guys with, mortar guns, and that's it. So what are we supposed to do? Line up anyways and ready in a formation to fight? What are we going to do? We're going to get slaughtered. There's nothing to do. I mean, then we just sit back and pray. So what's the point? What's the point of taking these steps that he took if, in point of fact, Esav was mightier than him and there was nothing he really could do anyways? He just needed God to protect him. In addition, we'll just ask some questions here. In addition, Aaron and I point out, Vayachat, this is Vayira Yaakov Yod, Vayetelo. And Yaakov was extremely affrighted, and he was in a state of duress. He was stressed with him, so he split the people. Ha'amah Sharito, the nation that was with him, and the sheep, and the flock, into two camps. And he said, interesting expression of his, Ha'amah Sharito, the nation. It seems like he was a small group. And why was he referring to him as a nation? But anyway, and he said, if Esav will come to one camp and smite it, then the other camp will remain, will be saved. Now, on the surface, that seems to make sense, but there's a problem with that. What's the problem with that? Now, that is, the idea of saving, what good is half a camp, I would say, is not a question, because you do the best that you can. If, if the house is broken into, robbers, murderers, whatever it is, you wouldn't say, either I could save the entire family. You try and hide the members of the family in different places, even maybe one of the saved. You wouldn't say what's the point of one being saved? I mean, what's the point? You want to save every life. That makes sense. Yeah, but why can't you then proceed to the next camp? What was the plan? Well, you'll attack one camp, and then what's going to happen? I mean, then the other camp will run away. And they'll run away.
Right.
And they'll be saved. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi comments on this. Vaya hamachneach hanishar lefleita al karko. Against his will. Meaning, there's a strategy here. Ki aloche nimo. Because I'll fight with him. What's he saying over here?
Dealing with is, what was the purpose of splitting up the camps? In a practical way. He'll come to one camp and he'll hit them so the other one will be saved. Whatever he does, then he'll go and kill the other camp. So the other one will be running away. Alright. So Rashi's saying, but Rashi is explaining something. Al Karcho. Ha-Machmish Leplet Al Karcho Ki Elochem Yom, because I'll fight with him. So what does that mean? According to you, it's not necessary to say those words, that I'll fight with him. According to you, he'll attack one camp and the other camp will run away. What does Allah mean want to do with it? Yeah, the plan apparently, I agree with Mayer, that it's not that simple. It means that he prepared for war. That's what Rashi said. He prepared himself for three things. With Doron, for a gift, with Tefillah, for prayer, and Mulchama. And then he shows how each one. And what's the Mulchama? V'hoyah machna anisha l'pleita. The Mulchama, because you don't see the preparation for Mulchama. You do not see the preparation for Mulchama overtly stated. Although everyone always mentions he prepared in three ways. So where does it say that he's ready? Where is it mentioned that he's ready to fight? It's not mentioned at all in the Pasuk. So where did the Chazal get the idea to be prepared for war? From the words, the machna initial of Plato. The only way that could be, apparently, was that he would split them up into two camps, and he will attack one camp. If he's coming to fight, he'll attack, and I'll fight back. If I don't fight back, then he'll massacre the one and he'll massacre the others. But I'll fight back and he will concentrate. He'll think that the entire force is located over here and I'll bog them down in a war and then they'll escape. They'll be able to escape. But they wouldn't be able to escape unless I engage him in war. So that's what Chazal is saying. You see from this that he definitely planned to engage him in war. You know, one can ask, how did he know? He says that I will fight with him. But he can only be in one camp, apparently. So how did he know which one Esav would attack? Unless we assume that it wasn't just a haphazard thing. That he positioned himself with the camp which would draw the attention of Esav and the other one, right? So what does it mean? But see, the wording of the pasuk is different, that if he attacks, the plain meaning of the words seems to indicate that he doesn't know which one will attack, but I'll break him up into two camps. I'll attack one, the other one will be a Plato. But now Rashi says, I'll fight with him. But that doesn't seem to fit, because that makes sense only if he knows which camp he's going to be attacking in the first place. But if Yaakov doesn't know which camp he's going to be attacking in the first place, then and we're saying that part of the plan is that I'll bog him down in a war, then there's a problem over there, because how does he know which camp he's going to attack? What if he attacks the other camp? That doesn't stand the question. He's dividing them into two groups, fine. So that is, if he attacks one, the other. But he doesn't know which one he's going to attack. But whichever one he attacks, the other one will escape. That's all very nice, but Rashi says part of the plan is that he would fight with them. Which presupposes that he's going to be in the camp that he attacks. But since he doesn't know which camp that's going to be, how can Yaakov say he's going to fight him? That's the problem. You read the puzzle. You have to change the way you read the puzzle. According to you, you're saying like this. Not v'hoya. Not in yavo eis ve'la machna achas v'ikol. I don't know if this is correct. I mean, let's just try it out. So Joel is saying that it's not that I don't know which camp he's going to come to. That if he comes to Camp A, then Camp B. But that means if I fail in my attempt to avoid the war, to appease him, and he decides to attack, right? Then the other camp, he'll attack a camp, and if he attacks Amachna Achas, means I'm going to split him up into two camps. And that, if I fail, and he attacks the one camp, and I know which camp that'll be, then the other one will survive. But the other one will be a plato, you see, will be not by chance, by haphazard. That'll be if my plan of appeasement fails, and he does decide to go to war. Then, and that's I have to read the Rashi. Ki alocha imo, because I'll fight him. The only other way to read it, and that makes sense, because, as Meir points out, that doesn't seem to be that difficult. Because you can have a sense of the direction that he's coming from, and you can position one camp so that he'll encounter that camp and make war with it, and the other one will escape. So Yaakov would be in the one that he's going to attack. Unless the only other way you could say it is Alachimbo doesn't mean personally, that I personally, literally, well, it makes more sense to say it that way, but I will fight him, meaning my people. I'll instruct. I'll put my commanders in both camps. He can't be in both. You can maintain the original way of learning and just take Rashi to mean that I will wage a war against him, meaning that I'm instructing my men to wage a war against him, but he may not be in the battle personally. Rafael's adding a good point. Rafael's adding a good point that if Yaakov, this would support the idea that Yaakov would be in the camp that was attacked, and Esav would have thought Esav doesn't know how many people he has, because Esav has to send out spies. Yaakov has sent out spies the other way, but Esav doesn't know, and it's quite possible that he would think that he's destroyed the entire family. But basically, we can also say this. Why don't we simply, given your idea, why don't we simply say, it just occurred to me, why don't we simply say that was his objective to wipe out all of the family, or was his objective just to kill Yaakov? the hatred was a hatred against Yaakov. But Yaakov apparently didn't believe that, because Yaakov was concerned that everybody would be killed. But why? This leads us to a question. Why would he have such a fear? Or the Chumash is only, the information that we have from the Chumash only leads us to the conclusion that there was a hatred. Esav hated Yaakov due to what had happened. The fact that he stole the brachos, that was the main cause. It was at that point in time he decided to kill him. But if that's the case, then why is he concerned about the entire family? And also you could say, if that's the case, why doesn't he just offer himself up? If everything fails, so then, why didn't Yaakov say, I'll offer myself up and save my, I could do the better way? Why do you have to break him into two camps? So if he destroys one camp, the other will be saved. That's very nice. The fellow says that they won't even have to run away, because Esav wouldn't even know that they're part of the family. I'm saying, even if Esav knew that they're part of the family, he's already done his, somebody I can mention, Joel, he's already done his dirty work. He has no need to go any further. But now that we've gone this far, so then there's another Esav, which is possible, and that is, give yourself up. They're only after you. Yaakov would do that. Because what do you gain by staying behind anyways and fighting to save your family? Then that camp will, you'll die in the war against Esav, and that camp will be killed. There's a simpler answer. Give yourself up as a hostage and let him do whatever he wants and leave the family alone, because he has no qualms. He has no battle with the family. So nothing makes sense here. Now this morning, as Joel wants to tie it in, we were doing the Rashi, right? Chet Pshat, and the Rashi, Vatayag Mitzvah Shamarti, that he communicated. That's not the, see, you have to understand where it is. The plain shot is that Yaakov was afraid of Esav, not because Yaakov represented Torah, and he had given up Torah. That's not the plain shot. The plain shot is because of what he had done. He was angry. You see, what we see in the development of the story, it says that he, Vayomer Belivo, after he stole the brachos, he decided in his own mind, in his own heart, that he would kill him. That's when Rivka found out about it. Right, so it was a specific event. Now that's the, I mean, Rashi explains in Love and Garthi in terms of a different cause of hatred. How do the two work together? What does one thing have to do with the other? But we, over here, we're dealing with the practical. We're dealing on the storyline. On the storyline, right? On the storyline, it's not an issue of anti-Semitism. On the storyline, it's a brother hating another brother who he believes has stolen his blessings, his materialistic blessings from him, and wants revenge. And Yaakov, on the storyline, is planning. Now we're talking about his practical plans, not his psychological devices, that he, you know, the suggestion that he still keeps mitzvahs and so forth, those types of things. We're dealing with the storyline.
Okay.
It says, there's something missing over here, because the Torah is presenting for us the cause. If you want to know the cause of this encounter, you have to go back to Toldos. In Perek of Zion, Pasuk Mamalos. It says, Vayistom Esav as Yaakov, and Esav hated Yaakov, Al HaBracha, because of the Bracha, Al here means because of, Asher Berachom, of it, that his father had given him. Vayomer Esav Belibo, and Esav said in his heart, Yikru Yimei Eva Lavi, the days of the mourning, in other words, I'll wait till my father dies, he's not going to do it during the life of his father. Vaharga Es Yaakov, Achi, I'm going to kill my brother Yaakov, that's it. And by Yugo the Rivka is Divrei Esav V'Nah Agadol. These words were told. All right, so the Rashi explains how if he didn't speak him, he only put them in his heart. So how was told to Rivka, whatever. And she found out about it, maybe through Nevuah, or maybe he told somebody. There's different shots. That's when she instructs Yaakov to leave to save your life. So all we know is that it's a personal hatred against Yaakov. And if that's the case, everything that's happening in Vayishlach doesn't make any sense, because in Vayishlach Yaakov is concerned for the salvation of the Ha'am. He's got a whole group of people over there to be broken up into two groups, and they're all going to be wiped out, when it's just a personal hatred against one person. Brothers, and alright, brothers can come to a point of hatred and one wants to kill the other. Esav really wanted to kill him, but that's it. Why is he even concerned in the first place that they're all going to be wiped out? Joel's asking another good question. If that's the case, you see something has changed. That strengthens my point, though. You see something has changed. Joel points out very well that the original plan of Esav, and I think Esav was not a flighty kind of person. Because if he was, you're the kind of person that reacts as an emotional reaction one day. Most people have that type of thing. Someone will insult you or whatever. You know, brother, you want to kill him. But that only lasts for a short period of time. This is around 20 years later, right? About 20 years later, he still has the same determination. He was a man of conviction, a man of commitment to whatever his false ideas, but he was committed to it. Thought out person. He thought out his moves. Otherwise, he wouldn't be a rusher. He wouldn't be dangerous. And the plan was to wait until the death of Yitzchak. As Joel points out, at this point in time, Yaakov may not have known the Yikru Yimei Eval. Maybe Yaakov didn't know that, so Yaakov could be afraid. But didn't Esav say he's going to wait until the Eval Yitzchak, and he's still alive Yitzchak at this point? Well, that's what Joel said.
Yeah,
you should know a famous Rashi. You should be able to figure out quickly from a Rashi he's still alive. But that's calculating years. Because how many years was Yosef separated? How many years was Yosef separated from
Yaakov?
Right, and that was considered to be an onesh, because for 22 years he wasn't involved in Kibbutz Aviyim, correct? Does that not presuppose for the entire 22 years the Aviyim were in existence, such that he could fulfill the mitzvah of Kibbutz Aviyim, but did not do so?
Mm-hmm.
Had the parent died, it would have been a different amount of years. Yeah, the Pasuk openly says it in Perek Lamed Hey, Pasuk of Zion, Vayevo Yaakov al Yisrael Gavim, he came to his father Yitzchak, Mamre Kiryas Abi, he Chevron, Asher Gorsham Avram Yitzchak. Then it says that the days of Yitzchak were 180 years, and then he died. And it says, Vayikru Oso, Esav Yaakov Bono, he was buried by Yitzchak. You're correct, Joel is correct, by the way. Interesting, but Esav did come to bury his father. He came to bury his father. Interesting idea. Now, because he did have Kibbutz. No, but we always said that the Kibbutz in practice was for ulterior motives. But here he's dead. Here he died, and hopefully he came to bury it. All right, we'll return to that. But this strengthens the point. The point then is that Esav had said that he would wait for the death of his father, and then he would get even with Yaakov. So we have two issues. First of all, his gripe is only with Yaakov, and secondly, he's able to postpone it. That is another characteristic of the Russia, that he's able to postpone his gratification. Otherwise, he wouldn't be. The first time he's immediate gratification, gets into problems. Because he does things that are irrational because of his instinctive need. But a dangerous person is one who can bide his time. Wait. And that is to say, he'll suppress his anger, his need for immediate revenge, and he'll wait. He's a dangerous person. Because he's an enemy, and he's not going to make a move. He's a calculated person. He's rational, and therefore, your vulnerability is that much greater. And you see that Esav was able to wait. He was able to wait, and he would get his revenge in due time. And if that's the case, then Yaakov should have been in a safer position. But you're going to say, well, Yaakov may not have known about the Abel part, that he was waiting until his father died. He may not have known that. It's not clear whether Rivka knew that or not. But at all events, we see that a change occurred in Esav's plan on two levels. One, that the anger was not directed at Yaakov, the danger was against the entire family. But Yaakov was told by his mother that your brother is planning to kill you, which is a personal thing. And secondly, we see in fact that something had to change, that because it's not, Esav is moving against him, even though Yitzchak was still alive at this point. But that does lend support to the idea that a change had occurred. And we're still back with our question, why was there a need to worry about the destruction of the camps? Why didn't he simply offer himself as a hostage and say, here, take him? If, of course, the avenues failed. I think Yaprol is saying as follows. It's a sophisticated shot. He's saying that we shouldn't take it that literally, that the objective, the anger and the hatred was against the person of Yaakov. That's my question. If that's the case, then give yourself up. That's how I would take it. But what Yaprol is suggesting is the anger is against the person of Yaakov. The desire to kill, though, is not just the result of the anger. Because anger doesn't last 22 years. You get over anger. But what he really cannot tolerate is the loss of the brother. He can't tolerate the loss of the brother. But you'll ask, so if that's the case, if he kills Yaakov, he's not going to get it either. Now you answer that question. And we're taking the logical steps that are necessary for your position. So then what's he going to gain? So you're saying it's not really the hatred anymore, but it's the loss of the brother. But if you're going to kill, there's no indication that if Yaakov is out of the picture, Yitzchak will now give the bracha to him. This bracha we're talking about is the materialistic. Let's be realistic about that. Whatever it is, I don't think that he's trying to avoid that fact that he'll be ruled over by him or that type of thing. I mean, he was very independent. He was in Seir. He had his own land. He had his own wealth. In fact, he says, they were arguing with each other. Who should take? You take mine. Right? He says, Yeshli Rav. He says, Yeshli Kol. They're arguing. I have a lot. I have everything, you know. I'll be back. That's a different issue. But I'm going to ask on referrals. Well, if that's the case, so then it does not really make sense at all. Why would you want to kill him? Because he's not going to get the problems anyway. So you're sort of caught in a little bit of a trap there. That's the way the Russia works. The way the Russia works is that it is not the desire for the bracha per se. That's indicated when he said Yeshli Rav. Because it's interesting, the languages are almost the same. You'll see that a little bit later in the parsha, when they have the reconciliation, and Esav is won over at that point. That's another thing maybe we'll follow up on this next week. But what was the strategy of Yaakov? But the idea of buying him off didn't seem to make sense at all. He doesn't want to kill you. The person wants to kill you, how are you going to buy him off? First of all, he's a wealthy guy, and then he can take the money and kill you anyway. You know, what was the plan? What was the donor? What was the, there was a strategy there. I'll pick that up. But nevertheless, it does work. And then he doesn't want to even take the gift. So you see, it wasn't the money that that accomplished it, but he finally prevailed upon it. But in saying so, he says, yes, he rub. And Rashi criticizes him. Take a look at the Rashi and yes, he rub. Talana Gimel. So, in fact, so Esav asked him after the reconciliation, they hugged, they kissed. After the reconciliation, he says, "What's all this abundance that I see? This machna, the camp." He says, "That's the fine favor in the eyes of my master." And Esav said, "Yeshti Rav." Esav was won over at this point. I have a lot. Achi, my brother, you the fresh lot. Keep what's yours. Okay? So you see, he had a lot. Vayom Yaakov and Yair Alma. And no one says he came Yenecha. If I found favor in your eyes, Lakakhtam and Kasi Miyadi. Please take my gift from my hand. And insisted upon it. Of course, we have to understand why. Why did he insist upon it? At this point in time, if that is your strategy to prepare a tremendous offering to someone to win him over, and he's totally won over, and then you've achieved your objective, you've saved your life, and you can keep your money. So of course, keep your money. Why give it to him? Why did he insist upon that he should take it? That's difficult too. And at this point in time, he says, "Ki al kein reishi panam kiros tnei Elohim by this thing," which means Rav Vaya, a great person. Take the blessing that I brought you, Kifanani, Elohim, because God has been merciful to me, the Kiyeshi told. And I've got everything. He implored him, you see that was an extremely important idea, that he wanted to take the gift under any circumstances. The thing is, though, that Rashi is very critical of Esau, because he said, Yeshli Rav. Take a look at Rashi there. Yeah, but just take a look at the words of Yeshli Rav. Yirala, Rashi, Yeshli Kol, Kol Sipukai, all of my needs. The Esav Diber B'Lashon of Gaiva. Esav spoke in the Lashon of Gaiva, haughtiness. Yeshli Rav, I have a lot. Yosef V'Yosef L'Chdei Tzarkei, more and more than I need. That's very interesting. The expressions on the surface seem to be almost identical. Cold, I have everything. You say you have everything, that's okay. You say you have a lot, then that's the Lashon of Gaiva. Why? Why? See, because there's very few people in the world that would say Yeshli Kol. Kol is an expression of a perfected individual that has the proper relationship to the three enemies. He's not living in the world of fantasy. A person that has a clear-cut idea of what the purpose is in life, and he knows that he has necessities, he has a clear measure of what his necessities are, so then he can evaluate the situation, and he can say, yes, I have everything I need. But there's no person in the world that will say that. You have everything, there's always desire. Why? Because you're living in fantasy. As long as you're living in fantasy, there's another fantasy out there. You can't know. You talk to the wealthiest person in the world and ask them to get everything, I'm going to say that. Because there's somebody else that's got something out there. There's somebody else. That's what Rav is in the world. Yeshli Rav means I have a lot. That's already comparative. A lot relative, that means relative to somebody else. Relative to, I'm in good position, I have more. I have more than you have. I have more than most people have. So that's the satisfaction that he's getting. See? So that's a different framework. That's where Farouk Shah is correct, that it's not so much that he has to have the bracha, but he can't tolerate that Yaakov would have it. But there's something out there, and somebody else has it, and not him. That's a blow to his ego. That he couldn't tolerate. So he's not just going to just kill Yaakov wouldn't be enough, because then the brachas would be inherited by Yaakov's children. So the brachas would still be in existence, and somebody else and somebody else would have them, then he'd be in the same situation. So what he meant when he's going to kill him out means he's going to destroy. He's going to destroy the entire movement. He's going to destroy his whole existence. Not just he's going to destroy the Bach. He's going to destroy the one who's the inheritor of Yaakov, insofar as Yaakov is the inheritor of the brachos. Insofar as Yaakov is the inheritor of the brachos, they continue to go on after him. So therefore, he would wipe out his entire family as well. That's what Rafael suggested. That's what Yaakov understood. That therefore, to give himself up as a hostage wouldn't be sufficient. So let's say he'd kill him. But then his family would go on, and they'd have the brachos. So Yaakov would still be a defeated person. Yaakov was trying to undo what Yitzchak had done. He wanted to undo the Kabbalah Sabrachah that Yaakov had accomplished. In order to do that, it wasn't sufficient to just destroy him. He's going to have to wipe out his entire family as well and leave no remnant or trace. That's what he had planned on doing. Of course, you do see, though, that insofar as he said he will wait for the day of Abel, others, there a change would occur. That requires an explanation. Because you see that Esav is moving, and he did come with a group of 400 people. It's not clear, though. It's not that clear from the pasuk itself. Yaakov took it to be a sign of danger. Avraham Eozish, and he won him over. It's not that we don't know if Esav was coming with the intention of killing him and he was won over, or he wasn't coming with the intention. And that's not that clear. Plain shot would seem to be, the way the story is being presented, is that it was the strategy of Yaakov which succeeded, and it was, of course, getting back to the first Ramban, the Ashkach of God, that God saved him from someone who was stronger than him, which the implication is that that person was prepared to kill him. Because if it was not the case, then the Ramban would have said that, or the Torah would have said that he was wrong, Yaakov, and that Esav wasn't really going to kill him anyway. But the clear implication of the parasha is that he was going to kill him. Yeah, explains what the strategy of Yaakov was. That's why it says Am. That's why he used the expression of Am. The Am Asher Yimel. And the plan of Machne Hanisha Lefleita wasn't simply an issue of saving every life, which is true, it was done right. But it was more than that. It was to retain the movement. The family would continue. So there'd still be a Yerusha. Yerusha Sabrachos. And the movement would go on. To save the Shvatim. That was his real objective. Above and beyond everything else, the splitting up of the Machna was, I will utilize Milchama. But the plan was not, it's not just in the context of saving a life or two, but to save what he represents, to save the lineage, so that the movement, the system, can continue through my children. So you split up the children into two camps, and I'll fight with them to the term, and some will survive, and the system will go on, and I will thwart his plan. He will thwart his plan that way. Because the plan was not any longer just an issue between him and Yaakov. The plan was to undo the giving of the brachos. That's an important point. And the undoing of the giving of the brachos meant not just in the person of Yaakov, but anyone who would take the place of Yaakov. Because he couldn't tolerate that somebody else should have a brachos.